From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula. Hello, and welcome to Korean Context. My name is Jenna Gibson. I'm the Director of Communications here at KEI, and I'll be your host today. We have a very exciting episode today for you. We're going to be talking about sanctions and North Korea, both on the U.S. level and on the international level. So here to speak with us today, we have William Newcomb. He is on the U.N. Security Council panel of experts for the DPRK from 2011 to 2014. He previously worked on North Korea for the State Department as well, and he was retired from the U.S. Treasury Department. We also have today Daniel Wirtz. He's a program officer with the National Committee on North Korea, and he has been studying the U.S. sanctions regime extensively. So we're really looking forward to getting some insight from these two about the new U.S. sanctions and the U.N. sanctions, which were passed just yesterday, and wanting to talk to them about what they might mean for the DPRK going forward. So to start us off, can you both give our listeners some of the key changes that are important to know about this new round of sanctions? So let's start with Daniel on the U.S. sanctions, and then Bill, you can go into the U.N. resolution. What are some of the key changes here?
All right, Jenna, well, thanks for having me, and I just want to preface by saying my remarks today are my own and don't represent the National Committee on North Korea. On the new U.S. sanctions law, the North Korea Sanctions and Policy Enhancement Act that passed in February, it's got some significant new changes for U.S. sanctions policy. There's a lot of different moving parts in it, but some of the key elements are, number one, new mandatory sanctions that the president is required to issue if certain requirements are met. If the U.S. government finds, for example, that a certain entity, either North Korean or in a third country, is contributing to North Korea's WMD program, contributing to arms sales, illicit activities, other certain verboten activities, then the U.S. is mandated to sanction that entity. It's not discretionary on the part of the president. And that's a major change from how sanctions have worked. Second, some of those mandatory sanctions deal with North Korea's mineral and coal exports, which is another major change for the sanctions regime, dealing more with commercial trade now rather than arms, WMD, illicit activities. It's been the focus in the past, and that's also touched on the UN resolution, which I'm sure Bill will mention later in the podcast. Third, there are new human rights and cybersecurity-related sanctions in the bill. Depending on how these are applied, this could potentially be targeted toward some of North Korea's laborers overseas, which have been a growing source of hard currency earnings and something that the human rights community has been increasingly focused on the last few years.
Okay, great. And then on the UN level, what are some of the key changes there?
Well, I also want to thank you for inviting me here today. It's nice to be back at KEI. The UN sanctions, I think they surpass everyone's expectations about what could be accomplished in the negotiations between Washington and Beijing, which would the principal source of debate over content. It is a bit unfortunate that in consultation with Russia, some of the provisions in the draft got a little bit weakened, and one of the designated individuals was removed at the request of the Russians. That said, the past resolution remains exceptionally strong. One of the things it does is to try to eliminate existing loopholes in the three previous Chapter 7 resolutions, as well as the fourth resolution, 2087, which was not Chapter 7. It only invoked the language. These loopholes had allowed various member states to exploit some ambiguities. They also tried to rationalize violations of sanctions by looking at their own definition of what was and wasn't included in sanctions to defend their actions. A good case in point is Cuba's defense of sending military weapons to the DPRK aboard the Chongqing, which it said for the most part was for repair, but the investigation at the panel showed that that was not a credible explanation. Other countries have been receiving training for police and armed forces, clearly forbidden in the resolutions. They were arguing that it wasn't. This new resolution makes clear that all of these activities are prohibited. So I think the measures go a long way to clear that up. Second, they extend the trajectory of two critical paths to contain the DPRK. One is on transport. So they go after overflight rights of aircraft. They go after the DPRK's ability to use ships to carry cargo. And they call for mandatory inspection of all cargo to and from the DPRK. That is not as burdensome as it might seem, because containerized traffic in and out of North Korea is not very vast. The majority of it goes through the port of Dalian. So there will be early on a chance to see whether or not China is fulfilling the resolution in a robust fashion, as it has agreed to do so. One of the other trajectories that has been extended is toughening up on financial sanctions, particularly on the ability of North Korea to deal with financial services abroad, as well as banks dealing with North Korea. So there's supposed to be a tightening down on correspondent accounts. North Korean officials overseas that often operate as procurement agents or help established front companies and shell companies are going to be under even stronger vigilance. And if found involved, there is a demand for their expulsion from the country involved. They're to be sent back to the DPRK, unless there's an important exception, unless there are reasons to detain them for judicial reasons or so forth. So it doesn't mean that an official who doesn't have diplomatic status can't be charged. Also, the assets freeze provisions has been extended. It clarifies that the vessels that are owned or controlled by OML are indeed economic resources as defined in earlier resolutions. Some countries had argued that ships were not resources, but this makes clear that anything that can be bought, sold, rented, mortgaged, or otherwise produce income is absolutely an economic resources, and it specifies including vessels. It provides a list of OMM-associated vessels, so nations like Russia can no longer argue that the evidence linking ships to OMM is insufficient and not grounds to take action. So all in all, I think this is an extraordinarily powerful set of measures. I'm cautiously optimistic that there will be a newfound political will to implement them, but that has always been a problem. Only about half of UN member states have implemented resolutions, including 1718, which was passed in 2006. Without correct and thorough implementation and robust enforcement of the measures, it's a piece of paper.
You've talked about this and the strength of the resolution. The White House, the State Department, the UN, they are calling this the strongest set of sanctions passed in 20 years. They're saying it's much stronger, really going to squeeze the North Korean regime. It seems like you would agree with that, that it's much stronger than in the past. Do you think that this is really going to be what it takes, or is there room for making it even stronger going forward?
There are always more tweaks. For example, on the assets freeze. Countries are not required to report what has been frozen. So it's really hard to know whether the assets freeze is being implemented thoroughly and correctly. The same is true with denying travel of designated individuals. There's no requirement for member states to report to the 1718 Committee, Security Council, or the panel of experts about their enforcement of this measure. So again, how do you evaluate the effectiveness if you're unable to do a count? The inspection provision, which now includes all cargo, under earlier resolutions, member states are required to report to the committee on any inspection that they carried out. It doesn't matter whether they found something prohibited during the inspection. If they found something prohibited, there are certain other measures that they're required to do. But the sheer fact that they conducted an inspection, they're required to report. And member states have been not following that. even though it's an international obligation imposed upon them by the Security Council. There's no ambiguity in this.
Right. So I want to get back to the U.S. side for a moment. And this is something that I'm particularly interested in, being that I've studied human rights and things like that. And one thing that I noticed is that, you know, in the U.S., there's been a lot of talk about human rights generally, and particularly with North Korea. But it seems like this new sanctions bill, as it was moving through Congress and as it is passed, it connects human rights to the broader conversation about North Korea in an unprecedented way. Do you see this as an important step, you know, connecting human rights and the security issues related to North Korea?
Yeah, well, it's a new step in some important ways. I think previously, U.S. approaches to North Korea's nuclear program and human rights have been on somewhat separate tracks, like the agreed framework and six-party talks focused exclusively on North Korea's nuclear program, with the idea that once we get past that, we can start addressing human rights issues before normalization. There have been separate human rights and security discussions at the UN, with the Security Council handling the resolutions after North Korea's missile or nuclear tests, and the Human Rights Commission or the General Assembly dealing with issues related to North Korean human rights. So the new bill does combine them in a new way. In some ways, really reinforces some of the aspects of the UN sanctions bill when it comes to sanctions on minerals or port inspections, which the new law also has some language related to that. But on human rights, there's some language in the U.S. law that's not, there's no parallel in the UN sanctions resolution because China, Russia didn't want to deal with human rights. So issues like North Korean laborers abroad, which could be a target of unilateral U.S. sanctions, that could become an issue and possibly a point of tension between the U.S. and Russia and China, which host the majority of these laborers, if the U.S. issues those kind of sanctions. And there's also language in the new law that discusses U.S. government identifying North Korean individuals and institutions responsible for human rights abuses, including personal responsibility of Kim Jong-un. And, you know, as you'll recall, last year when the UN was considering the UN Commission of Inquiry's report on North Korean human rights, the recommendation that Kim Jong-un face potential charges at the International Criminal Court was something that North Korea reacted extremely strongly to. And U.S. finding that Kim Jong-un is guilty of human rights abuses that warrant new sanctions could have a very powerful symbolic effect and could also warrant a very strong North Korean reaction to that.
So we did a little roundup of all the things that the U.S. presidential candidates have been saying, and this is something that came up over and over again, is that China needs to do more. We need to pressure China to do more. That's the way in for North Korean change, I guess. And in this case, the U.S. and China worked together to draft this resolution on the U.N. level. And recent moves may indicate that China is willing to push a little harder on North Korea. So, Bill, do you think that China is now willing to do what these politicians are saying they should do and fully implement and enforce these sanctions?
Well, I mean, that's the key question, isn't it? Certainly in the past, China could have done a lot more. The DPRK military sources its trucks in China. China has accepted end-user certificates that say that these won't be utilized for military purposes, and then North Korea turns around and mounts rockets and so forth in the beds of these trucks. The, 16-wheel MRL from a few years ago is a good case in point, but it's not the only case. There have been subsequent imports by DPRK. Fool me once, I could sort of accept. Fool me twice, I can't. So it's clear that there are things that could be done that China has not yet done, and I'm hopeful that it will start doing that in future. Also, I think we all understand that China's security services are first rate. They seem to be very aggressive, quite knowledgeable, and effective in doing whatever they're tasked to do. It's inconceivable to me that North Korean front companies can operate as they do in China without the knowledge of the security services. It's inconceivable to me that North Koreans representing designated banks and COMID can operate in China without the Chinese knowing they're there. So I think that China has ample room to prove its seriousness as it goes forward.
So along with the announcement that the UN Security Council passed the new sanctions resolution yesterday, at the same time, the Treasury Department released their list of some of the entities that would be falling under the U.S. sanctions. So I assume this was somewhat deliberate, trying to time it at the same time. But in any case, it makes me wonder. So this is a question for both of you, I guess, and we'll start with you, Daniel. But do you see these two sets of sanctions as complementary, or do you see any issues that might arise when it comes to the U.S. sanctions and the U.N. sanction regimes being implemented at the same time?
In some ways, I do think that, yes, they are complementary, especially on the issues, as I've mentioned, of mineral exports, port inspections, cargo inspections. The U.N. resolution has some new language further restricting North Korea's access to the international financial system, and the U.S. sanctions law piggybacks on that a little bit. I think for the short term, if China abides by the U.N. sanctions resolution at first, decreasing its purchasing of North Korean coal and iron and other minerals, shutting down some of the North Korean overseas bank accounts, cutting off financial access, then I think that there will be, complementarity between the U.S. and U.N. sanctions, that there won't necessarily be a confrontation between the U.S. and China, or, the U.S. and other third countries where North Koreans operate, if these third countries implement the sanctions vigorously. But if a country doesn't implement the new U.N. sanctions vigorously, or if China, for example, begins by having fairly robust enforcement of sanctions, but then starts to, relax its enforcement as things on the Korean Peninsula calm down, then I think you could have the possibility for tension between U.S. secondary sanctions resulting from the new law and other countries that are tasked to enforce the U.N. resolution.
If I can jump in on that just briefly. When the measure discusses the North Korean export of iron ore and coal, it, in that particular paragraph, it also decides that there's an exemption. And that exemption allows purchases of these items from North Korea when it's for livelihood. And livelihood is an undefined term. So you could interpret livelihood as normal commercial transactions. Indeed, that's probably the way it's going to be read by many, because it's clear in other parts of this new resolution, as well as in past resolutions, that normal economic activity is not the target of these sanctions, only activity that contributes to the prohibited programs. So I think that that's an important exemption. And I could see under certain circumstances how this could run into conflict with measures in the new U.S. sanction, because here we have a U.N. exemption to something that at some point in future may not be permitted under a U.S. sanction measure. So there is that. There's another exemption about coal that's moving through the port of Rosan. That protects a narrow commercial interest, and it's, I don't think it's very consequential. A third exemption is on the import by North Korea of jet fuel, rocket fuel, and so forth. There was an additional sentence added to that, which allows for the purchase of jet fuel by aircraft outside of North Korea in the context of resuming flights back and so forth. The original language didn't prohibit that. It only prohibited the export onto North Korean territory. So I think that just is clarifying language, but it doesn't add to exemptions.
I think we could probably talk about all the details of this for a long time. But I do want to just give you both a chance to say, anything else that you think people really need to understand about these sanctions regimes. Again, they're very complex, kind of law language that some people wouldn't necessarily take the time to really understand. So to wrap up, is there anything that you want to add or want to make sure that people understand about these sanctions going forward? And I'll start with you, Bill.
Well, there's some other measures we never had time to get to, such as the prohibition on the export of gold. North Korea is a gold producer, and it can sell considerable quantities of non-monetary gold at any particular time. So while we may have an uptick in gold smuggling, North Korea certainly will suffer from this, as well as the prohibition on the export of rare earths and as well as precious metals. So I think that the drafters went through past resolutions, and I think they also looked at various categories of violations, trying to see what new language they could find that would be generally acceptable to close the doors and make it tougher. And I thought they did just an absolutely terrific job.
And I think it's also important to keep in mind sanctions in the kind of broader policy perspective. The question of, are sanctions going to put enough pressure on North Korea to get back to credible negotiations? Are they going to be enforced well enough that they'll really cut into North Korea's hard currency earnings? You know, there's, I think, an important question of how will North Korea adapt and innovate to try to get around the sanctions? And what will the impact on North Korea's growing role of pseudo-private industries, and what will that impact be? What will be the impact on market activities in North Korea? You know, all these questions, I think, are hard to really answer right now because it depends to a large extent on, you know, North Korea's response and what comes next. I think almost certainly, you know, in the wake of all these new sanctions being adopted, there will be more tensions on the Korean Peninsula. North Korea will lash out in various ways. We'll see what happens with their party congress coming up in a couple of months. But I think that's that broader policy context is important to keep in mind as we discuss sanctions.
If I could just put a footnote on what Dan said. The UN resolutions close with language saying that they will remain seized of the matter. I think it's very important that Washington remains seized of the matter as well. And it's important that the UN lives up to that statement. Both Washington and New York wax and wane in their treatment of this nuclear problem, as well as the human rights problem with the DPRK. In the past year, 2015, the 1718 committee that's charged with the implementation of sanctions met four times. And that's the minimum that's required to produce its 90-day report to the Security Council. That is almost criminal neglect of a very important issue. So I'm really hopeful that we find everyone involved remaining seized to the matter.
Okay, great. That's a great way to end our conversation. As I mentioned, it's a really important issue, but it's also one that people, I think, have a hard time wrapping their mind around in some cases because there's so much detail. So I really appreciate both of you coming here and giving us some insight and some background on these new sanctions. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all for this episode of Korean Context. If you haven't already, please take a moment to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts. We are coming back next week with another great episode, so we hope to see you then.